You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 12, today we're in Alpe d'Huez.
Well, Tom Pidcock just passed the line. The winner of Stage 12 and possibly the third ever British rider to win up here on Alpe d'Huez. Looks like Louis Mankies is going to come in second. And the peloton, well, the small group of GC favorites is just behind.
Well, we just heard then Tom Pidcock winning the mighty Alpe d'Huez stage on his debut Tour de France. An incredible performance by him. And it looks like you guys are putting out an incredible performance. They're sitting, you got your beers ready, it seems to be that you're at a rave already, but I'm going to say the immortal words, not where are we, Francois, but where are you, Francois?
We're actually at a place called Camp de Base, or Camp de Base, if you like. It's a kind of a strange mixture between a bar, a fast food
chain
yeah. Or something. I mean, it provides the food, it provides a little bit of booze, and it provides seats for us to talk to you. So, and it's obviously in L'Alpe d'Huez, the place where the race finished today. L'Alpe d'Huez is a classic of the Tour de France, as we know, a classic, you know, for riders, a classic in the history of cycling. It's also kind of a classic, how could I say, headache for the guys following the tour, because with the crowd at the top here, it's always, you know, a little bit difficult. You know, logistics for eating, drinking, sleeping are difficult. So you kind of have to know your way around to manage to have a bite, have a drink, and have a little bit of sleep.
And Ian Boswell, how does it compare to riding up Alpe d'Huez, having to feed yourself and find some beer on Alpe d'Huez?
It's definitely a circus. Yeah, I mean, it was funny. I actually have been up here a couple times before, and you never really see this side of it. I mean, we're sitting here. You probably can hear music in the background. There's a merry-go-round off to my right, and you know, it's the race is long since passed, but the party for Alpe d'Huez is probably just beginning in many sense for people who are staying up here for presumably the night, but possibly even a couple of days.
Now, I'm sure everyone saw the scenes on Alpe d'Huez, as always, a 24-hour party almost up there. But we should find out what happened in the stage. So here is the tale of the étape. Stage 12, and it's Bastille Day at the Tour de France. So in celebration of the tricolour, a trio of some of the most fearsome climbs, the Galibier, the Croix de Fer, and of course, Alpe d'Huez. Nilsson Paulus attacked from the flag drop, looking to get something from the race after shipping over 26 minutes on the yellow jersey the day before. Five chasers eventually joined him. They were Nelson Oliveira of Movistar, Anthony Perez of Cofidis, Kobe Goossens of Intermarché Wanty Gobert, Matty Louvel of Arkea Samsic, and Gerhard Schoenberger of B&B Hotels. The Jumbo-Visma guard at the front of the peloton allowed Giulio Ciccone to go solo in the shadow of the Galibier before Louis Mankies also slipped off the front in the wheel of his Intermarché teammate Georg Zimmermann. Working together, Mankies and Ciccone made it across to the break with 5 kilometres to go to the summit of the Galibier. Then Perez made his move, pushing away from his breakaway companions in an effort to reach the top first. Meanwhile, a once familiar sight. Chris Froome attacked the peloton, this time in pursuit of the breakaway 1.5 minutes ahead. Sure enough, Perez took the full whack of KOM points on the Galibier and started on the long descent. And with Froome still dangling 30 seconds ahead of the peloton, Tom Pidcock saw an opportunity. The Ineos Grenadiers rider struck out of the pack, descending in breathtaking style to catch Froome, and as a pair, they rode on to reach the breakaway. With 75 kilometres to go, the gap to the peloton stretched to as much as 7 minutes and 20 seconds. But as it waned on the Croix de Fer, Pidcock took it up at the front, almost instantly shelling Oliveira, Goossens and Schoenberger out the back. Perez lasted not much longer. Behind them, Van Hooijdonk led the Jumbo-Visma train. He chipped a minute off the deficit in the space of 3 kilometres. and so to the mythical final climb. Five riders leading the race into the 21 hairpins: Pidcock, Ciccone, Froome, Meintjes and Paulus, the latter being the first to succumb. Just over a kilometre later, Pidcock surged away, immediately distancing everyone, with only Meintjes and Froome showing any hope of chasing him down. By the time that Van Aert pulled off the front and almost to a standstill on the Alp, the yellow jersey Vingegaard still had three teammates at his disposal, with Primoz Roglic taking the helm. Nairo Quintana and David Gourdou, stars of yesterday's stage, were dropped. And as the infernal pace continued, so followed second place Romain Bardet and then Adam Yates. Among the baying crowds up the road, Pidcock's lead continued to extend to 30 seconds over Meintjes and 1 minute over Froome, with 4.5 kilometres still to race. Behind, only Tadej Pogacar, Geraint Thomas and Enric Mas could withstand the onslaught of the yellow jersey and his right-hand man Sepp Kuss. But ever the showman, Pogacar attacked at Dutch Corner of all places, taking only Vingegaard with him. An image already familiar at this tour, the pair rode onwards, with Thomas, winner here in 2018, steadily pacing himself back to them. Mas and Kuss eventually rejoined before it all happened again, with the 2 kilometre banner in sight. With all the yo-yoing behind, Pidcock continued to extend his lead all the way to the line. He took the stage win in flamboyant style in his debut Tour de France. Two huge rides from Meintjes and Froome saw them complete the stage podium. Pogacar couldn't shake the yellow jersey in his final sprint to the line, but with Bardet losing time, he moves up to second on GC behind Vingegaard. Thomas is now third on GC.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens, title sponsors of the Cycling Podcast. Now, you'll know by now that they have their own podcast too, the Super Sapiens podcast, hosted by Zylon van Eyck and Dr. David Lippmann. In a recent episode, they spoke to SD Works rider Ashley Moorman-Passio. Here's a clip.
For as long as I can remember, you know, I'm not really a great morning person. When I wake up, you know, I need a bit of time to wake up sort of slowly, 15 or 20 minutes just to myself to have a cup of coffee and then, you know, to be ready to face the world. Actually, from the Super Sapiens, I can now kind of understand it, because Carl used to think I'm just really being a difficult person, you know, like, come on, wake up. But yeah. Now I actually can show him on Super Sapiens. I'm like, I said to him, I swear to blood sugar thing, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I swear to blood sugar thing, because I feel lightheaded. I'm not really ready yet.
Find out more about Super Sapiens' system of continuous glucose monitoring, which can help tailor your fueling and training for success. Go to supersapiens.com.
Well, we're here, yeah, Ian. You actually climbed to L'Alpe d'Huez, but not by the usual route, by the other route, which is called the Sarenne. But now we are at the finish line, waiting for what is going to be a great, great win by Tom Pidcock. I mean, amazing, 22 years old, and he's going to win probably L'Alpe d'Huez on his first Tour de France.
Well, I was going to actually save this for when we speak at dinner tonight, but I was going to say, if he wins, this will be the third British rider to win in L'Alpe d'Huez. Do you know all? Well, if Pidcock wins, who are the other two?
So,
this is Stump the Chump.
Yeah, Geraint Thomas won in 2018, that's for sure. Bradley didn't win here. Chris Froome never won here. I'm trying to think of another British.
I'll give you a hint. We came up Col de Sarenne. So we didn't really win on Alpe d'Huez, but won in Alpe d'Huez. And it was also in the Dauphiné, not in the Tour de France.
can't remember.
It was Pete Kenner in 2017, and
true. Yeah,
Ben Swift was second.
Absolutely. Well, totally slipped my mind, but it's very true. Yeah. But well, yeah. Have you checked that there are no other British wins in any other races? It's going to only be the Dauphiné and all the Tour de France anyway.
Yeah, it's true. I did not check all of them, but I figured those were the two biggest races. But yeah, I mean, we are seeing a phenomenal display from Pidcock, and we've also seen a resurgence of Chris Froome as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we. I cannot put it. We've all been really sorry for Chris for a number of months and years, like thinking, will he ever, you know, be his former self? He's of course he's not back to his his old dominant self, his old flamboyant self. But he took his chance. He went into the break and he really held his, you know, his place in the and did his job in the break. And he's now going to finish near the front. And I mean, yeah, it's a kind of a resurrection. And I think that whatever we thought of Chris Froome at the time, it's great to see. It's great to watch.
Well, we're about 5K to go, so we should go tune in, and I might walk down the road a little bit and get some, get a little bit, see if I can get closer to the finish line.
Watch out for the gendarmes. Sometimes, you know, they might kick you out of the way, but I'll see you later.
Well, you heard Francois and I at the finish line, and surprisingly, Francois was not the only person who could not guess the three winners of Team Sky and Ineos who have won atop Alpe d'Huez. I was able to eventually get a hold of Rod Ellenworth over at the Team Ineos hotel, and he gave me a few minutes to chat, and surprisingly he could also not answer he knew the two riders who had won atop Alpe d'Huez, but the third rider he did not know.
I feel much better now, you know, not knowing myself. Yeah, you know, we tend to forget that the Alpe d'Huez has also been, you know, climbed in the Dauphiné. So, well, you know, congrats to Peter. We forgot about you, but yeah, I mean, L'Alpe d'Huez on the Tour is, in a way, you know, no disrespect to Peter Canock, but something else. I mean, what Tom Pidcock did today. I mean, we expressed our enthusiasm on the line, but what can I say? Chapeau, you know, 22-year-old, first Tour de France, he wins probably one of the two most iconic climbs in the Tour de France with the Ventoux. I was walking back from the line with our colleague Julien Preto from Reuters, and he was saying, "Well, here he is." I say, "Who's that?" Said, "Well, the next British Tour de France winner." You know, so I don't, you know, of course it's fanciful, you know, one of the podcast's favorite adjective, but really impressive performance today, and also at the finish. I mean, This guy is cold-blooded, you know, talking to the press, like, matter-of-factedly, like, well, yeah, sure, I won Alpe d'Huez, you know, like it was not so... He didn't seem, like, thrilled or a surprise or, you know, like he was just another step in the direction he's fixed to himself. Impressive.
Yeah, so let's hear from Rod. And actually, before we do, I do want to mention, I tried to speak to Tom at the top of the Col de Granon yesterday, and I said, "Hey, Tom, do you have a moment to speak?" And he said, "To speak about what?" And I presumed he thought I was going to speak about the bike race. So anyways, let's hear from Rod Ellenworth from Team Ineos.
Well, Rod, I had a debate with Francois Thomazeau that there have been three British riders who have won up on Alpe d'Huez. Two from the Tour. Can you name the third?
You know, you just got me now. I'm trying
to
think who. Yeah, who's the third?
It was in the Dauphiné, not at the Tour.
Ah, was it in the Dauphiné recently?
Swifty was second.
Oh, Pete Kenyok.
Yes, you got it.
Did he win up here, did he?
He did. We came up Col de Suren.
Yeah, I remember, actually. And him and Swifty were away. But, yeah, I didn't remember. My memory's not so good, mate.
Easy one to forget. But, I mean, Big stage. I mean, obviously, you know, Tom had an incredible ride today. Was this something planned, or is it just kind of the way the stage developed?
Well, you know, I think Tom came into the race, like, thinking, really, ideally, he was here to help the team and then look at stage wins. So, you know, absolutely planned. And obviously this morning, he was the one who was the most likely who could win up here. You know, Danny's a bit sick. Castro's not feeling great. So, you know, couldn't really rely on Danny. But Tom, brilliant. I mean, fantastic day, wasn't it? Yeah, like, really good.
I mean, it's huge. I mean, just for the team, for himself. I mean, I think there's a lot of, in the press room, everyone's asking, oh, can he be a GC rider? And you know, I think he's still too young. He still has ambitions at mountain bike and cyclocross and maybe some gravel stuff. Do you think he, I mean, you've seen enough athletes from, you know, from someone like G, you've seen him from a young age. Does he have clearly he has the ability, but does he have the desire to be a GC rider? Or is that something maybe down the road?
I think he does. I think he's that's what he's doing here. You know, he's searching and gaining the experience. I think who knows? You know, that's the thing. I mean, I always say it when G was, you know, 18, 19, 20, you'd never ever think he could win the tour. You know, not that you didn't think he couldn't, but it was like, you know, you just never know, do you? So I think you've got to follow riders' dreams. I think Tom is super, super ambitious. And who knows what he can do? I mean, I think that just shows his quality today. You look at his cadence all the way and everything was pretty spot on. His attention to detail is exceptional, to be honest. So, yeah, I think he, who knows and why not?
Well, and another good ride from G as well. He's up to third overall. Not say easy days, because there's nothing easy about Mond, but just try to stay safe and then try to make something happen in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, you know, I've been saying for quite a while, you know, I think G's in really good shape, mentally really good. And I think, as you know, he's one of the guys who can stay. You know, he's a real stayer, isn't he? You know, and he plays a long game. And I just think he... you just don't know what's going to happen in the tour. And if there's somebody who can do something in the final of this race and just stay at a real even level the whole way, will be Geraint, you know. And he's super motivated. And I think just something like today obviously lifts the team, you know. And I think the others will now want to sort of keep pushing, you know.
Now, Boz, I know that you obviously rode, under Rod Ellingworth for many years. How different is the Ineos Grenadiers plan than it was in the days when you were riding there?
Yeah, like I did ride under Rod. I mean, you know, he was at Ineos, I think, the entire time, or I guess Team Sky, the entire time that I was there. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as we just heard, you know, Pidcock came here with a very kind of unique role, in the sense that, you know, Ineos has been a team that traditionally comes to the tour with a specific goal, with one team leader, and kind of everyone is committed to that one goal. And Pidcock has almost kind of had a free role here to hunt stages. And, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, the last time that Ineos has won the tour. I mean, Geraint Thomas isn't in the position at the moment to win, but contend GC, but also send someone else up the road for a stage win. I mean, maybe I'm forgetting something, but traditionally it's been, you know, kind of all for one and one for all. And we're seeing here that, you know, they kind of are implementing some of these tactics that they've talked about implementing, is, you know, being a little bit more aggressive and actually racing the race.
Pidcock himself, at the end of the day, the only thing, there were two things he said in the press conference that was interesting in the way they were very genuine. Like you could feel the teenage side of him. He was asked what it felt to ride on his own in the lead, in that sea of people up the mountain. And he said, "This is the most ridiculous thing ever." You know, it was his first reaction, and we can see why he could say that, because yes, that there is this amount of ridicule. You know, it is ridiculous in a way, but in the same time, he also said it's also the most exciting moment of my life so far. So you know, that's La Bez, a mixture of ridiculous and grandiose, you know, grand, something absolutely out of the ordinary. And the other thing he said that was interesting, he was impressed by, was to be in a break up front with Chris Froome. You know, like you imagine two generations of British riders, Tom Pidcock, the up and coming star, and Chris Froome, the fading one, and together in that break, obviously he felt, you know, something. You know, he was not emotional, I wouldn't say that, but you know, it was like, you know, he was pinching himself.
Yeah, well, I guess I noticed this kind of in the, you know, the final 5K when he was by himself, that, you know, he is, I mean, clearly Pidcock has been in positions before where people have been loudly cheering for him, but to think, you know, for someone like Froome, who's been up Alpe d'Huez a number of times and had people, you know, screaming and shouting, and you know, today more so in a positive way than a, you know, maybe a negative way in the past, and how much more maybe energy Pidcock got from the fans than maybe someone like Froome would get, because he's done it before. And for Pidcock, you know, to know the legend and the myth of Alpe d'Huez, and to be off the front, and I'm sure something was going through his mind, the, you know, what he was doing, you know, because it is such a famous climb. I guess, you know, when I did the tour in 2018, you know, in my mind the night before the race, I thought, you know, I'm going to be in the front on Alpe d'Huez, and turns out I was in the back in the gruppetto. But it is, you know, for whatever reason, such a mythical climb and such a famous climb. And, you know, the fact that you have so many fans on the side of the road, you know, definitely probably encouraged someone like Pidcock more than what even someone like, you know, Vingegaard or Pogacar, just because this is his first time at the Tour de France. This is his first time experiencing it, and everyone else has experienced it before.
The thing that's missing now, I think, we have Dutch corner, and I mean, we could see, I mean, Jumbo Visma riding in a sea of Dutch fans. We had the Danish corner and Norwegian corner, oddly, are becoming, you know, very important parts of the climb. Where is British corner? It's about time, you know, with two winners. listeners, fans, you know, please, you know, the next time we go to L'Albès, we hope to see a British corner.
There's a Welsh corner, François.
The Welsh corner exists, it's true.
And I believe there's a Beefeater Bend where people dress up in like Beefeaters, like the Tower of London.
No, it's nice,
guards.
The Welsh corner, but it's a little bit too small for now. And I think that with Geraint winning it, I know Pidcock, you know, it must really be beefed up, you know, where you're mentioning.
Beefed up, very good. Beefed up.
All about the puns. Actually, I did run into Geraint Thomas's wife at the finish line. I didn't record anything. G calls her Sa, but I think her name is Sarah. But I think maybe it's a Welsh thing. And she was actually planning on heading down she was saying the switchback number 13 was where Geraint Thomas has his name up on the plaque. There's a name of every former winner of Alpe d'Huez on each turn of, I guess, the 21 turns of Alpe d'Huez. And she was hoping to get down there on her e-bike with her kid. But she wasn't able to just because the road was closed. So she was at the finish line to see G and their son Max was sprawled out on the pavement, being a kid and playing and enjoying it. So it was you know, unfortunate that she couldn't make it down to turn 13, but happy to be able to see G have a good ride as well.
Well, Geraint Thomas was on just typical Geraint Thomas form, wasn't he? I mean, we kept seeing the attack by Pogacar, Vingegaard following in his wheel, and then just a steady climb back by Geraint Thomas. But, I mean, now I'm stepping into the old fanciful territory, but, you know, realistically, where can we see the challenges to the yellow jersey coming from?
Yeah, well, I mean, we heard a little bit from Rod that, you know, G is such a steady and consistent rider, and I think we saw that today. You know, he's incredibly experienced as well, so when, you know, attacks are happening, he just, you know, he settles in, he rides his pace. You know, by no means is the tour over. And when you look at the GC, there's, what, 2.5 minutes to, I guess, Pogacar in second place. You know, we have a couple easier days coming up, but, you know, I guess in the past, had Pogacar had 2.5 minutes, we would have called the race over maybe. You know, the traditional Pogacar would have, you know, ridden away with it. But I still feel that the race is very open. And I think we kind of observed that by how the race was played out today.
Even though I think, you know, apart from that top, you remember last year when you had the trio, Pogacar, Carapaz, Vingegaard, I mean, you know, in whichever order you want to put it, greatly the same trio seems to emerge. Only, you know, Geraint Thomas replacing Richard Carapaz in that Ineos Grenadier. Because behind that, Bardet is now down to fourth. He's not far away, but he showed his limits maybe a little bit today. Adam Yates, all these guys, you have the impression that, you know, the gap has been made. You've got three guys, you've got two guys, let's face it, they are really favourites to win the tour now, obviously. But, you know, we can't rule out, you know, Thomas, because, as you say, he's consistent, he's steady, anything can happen, crashes, COVID cases, I'm not wishing for any of this. But, you know, given the way Thomas is pacing himself and is, you know, just at the right place all the time, well, you know, a podium place is more than possible, and even a little bit better, who knows.
This year, the Cycling Podcast laid down a challenge to our partners, MAP, to create three brilliant jersey designs. They are Check, Dot and Fade, and we all know by now which one Francois's favourite is. So let's hear from the designer, Misha Glisevic, telling us about the inspiration for the first design, known as Check.
The Check era, which is kind of, to me, the original kind of cycling jersey design, the woolen jerseys, seems to have lived on a lot longer than I thought it had in my head, you know, because I was imagining the copy era, you know, 1940s to 60s kind of period as being the woolen knit jersey era. But once I delved into it, actually turns out that it was well into the 70s they were still using woolen knit jerseys as the primary jerseys. I think I've taken a fair bit of leeway there with the colours, because they were quite primary during that period, and I've kind of tried to add a bit of a map vibe to them by adding a few contrasting colours. So I have taken some design leeway there, but I think primarily during that period there were very minimal colours, a primary kind of colour palette, and as they were knitted, they had to be quite simple. So the check was probably the most elaborate design element that they would use, but it was mostly stripes and block colours. I think also the font styles that I've used is kind of reminiscent of those 60s and 70s jerseys that, you know, had, I guess, branding of the period wasn't as defined. It was a sausage manufacturer or, you know, a local car dealership that sponsored the teams. So the fonts were a bit wilder and stuff. And they were usually, rather than being printed, they were usually embroidered on.
Take a look at Czech and the other designs, and most importantly, vote for your favourite at map.cc. That's MAAP.cc.
Well, the third day and installment of Breakfast with Boz here on the tour. Today I'm going to call it Breakfast with Boz au pied. I walked from our accommodation here in Briançon over to a little bakery and I picked up something different. They had an almond croissant, but it didn't look fantastic, so I went with a pain au raisin and a quiche champignon. That is mushrooms for all of you non-French speakers. I'm sure you can all pick up that pain au raisin is a piece of bread with raisin, although there is some custard type filling in there, but very delicious. Cost me €4.90, so not bad for a breakfast. Picked up a little coffee before that, and hopefully it is enough fuel to get me through my plan today, which is to see the riders at the start as much as I can, and then most likely follow them or duck out early and try to lead the race over the Col de l'Arderet and then head over to Alpe d'Huez. I actually don't think I'm going to try to ride Alpe d'Huez itself because I think it's going to be a little bit busy. So I may try to take the hipster's way up Alpe d'Huez, which is the Col de Serein, a climb I did in 2016 or 17 in the Dauphiné, and my teammate at the time, Pete Kenna, actually won the stage. So it's a familiar climb. It's only 68K, but it's a big climb. So I'm trying to do some quick mental math and see if I can beat, well, I'll definitely beat the race there because they're going way around the Galibier, Col de Croix-de-Feu, and then up Alpe d'Huez. So I should be beating them even if I left after them. But the last thing I want to do, being here on the tour working, is miss the race because I'm out playing around on my bike. So I'm going to get back to our accommodation for the night, speak with Francois, and come up with a final plan. But I would love to try to get in a longer ride today because it is Bastille Day, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of people out on the road. And as I walk back here in Briançon, there is a lot of cyclists out. It is a national holiday here in France, so hopefully we can get out for a long ride and chat with some people out on the race.
Well, I beat the publicity caravan to the top of the Col de Tourmalet, and I actually had time to stop and grab a beer. It is 12:01, so I figure it's an adequate time to have a beer. And I'll be up here for a while, and this caravan is quite the show. People are trying to grab all sorts of things. A van with a chicken on it just came by throwing out sliced lunch, chicken lunch meat. I wasn't able to get up the Galibier. I could, I guess, walk around the side, but given that I'm in bike shoes and have a bicycle, I think I'm just going to stay here at the intersection of the bottom of the Galibier and, I guess, the top of the Col de Tourmalet. I can see up the Galibier, and it's an absolutely stunning sight to see the switchbacks and the caravan slowly zig its way up. I did have a completely closed course coming up the Tourmalet. The road was closed, but I was able to get through all the gendarmes with my press pass, which made it easy. Actually, a Spanish gentleman sat on my wheel for a while and was very thankful that he was able to follow me because he got quite far up the climb and he had anticipations of making it to the top of the lottery. But at one point, he got distant, so sorry, buddy. I had to try to make it up here before the press caravan. Well, I'm going to sit back and enjoy this beer, soak up the sun, and wait for the riders to come by. Well, here comes the peloton, about a minute 50 behind. We have Jumbo leading the way, and it looks like the peloton's all together. No Gruppetto yet. We have Jumbo on the front. Movistar's up there, as well as Simon Geschke in the polka dot jersey. We've seen quite a few EF riders near the back. And it looks like no gruppetto has yet formed. I see Caleb Ewan pulling up the rear. A lot of these sprinters are going to be happy that they've made it to the base of the Glibier still intact, and with the breakaway 2 minutes up the road, I suspect that some of these GC riders may actually make it over the top of the Glibier. It doesn't look like they're pushing the pace too far or too hard, but by the time they get to the Croix de Fer, I assume that we'll see some action. So I'm going to get on my bike and head over to do the Col de Sirene and meet up with Francois at the top at the famous Alpe d'Huez.
Well, there you heard the third installment of Breakfast with Boz, and it was more than Breakfast with Boz today. It kind of turned into a whole day of eating and drinking. I eventually got to the top of the Col de Lauderay, where I beat the race, the caravan of, you know, publicity. So I got to the top, I had a Coke, I had a beer, and I even had an ice cream. And I waited up there, and it's very easy on the Tour de France to forget how long you're actually out there. It was 2 hours up on top of this climb, and I thought, okay, cool, the race is passed, I'll drop down and I'll go up the Col de Sirene. And it got really hot in the valley. And I started climbing up, and it looked like the road was closed. Well, there were signs that the road was closed. And so I stopped in a little town. Francois might know the name of it.
Villard. It's Villard or something. That's just a nice little village up up the Col de Sirene. It doesn't come back to me, but yeah.
Yeah, so I stopped there, and I thought, you know, it's been a long time since breakfast. So I stopped and got a pizza and another Coke at 2K into the climb. And in the anticipation that there's a chance that I may get up near the top of the climb and the road is going to be closed and I'm not going to be able to make it to Alpe d'Huez. Turns out I was able to get by on my bike, but it blew me away at how quiet that road was. You know, it's one valley over from Alpe d'Huez. And there was no one. There was, you know, maybe I saw two cars, a few people out hiking, and then I dropped into Alpe d'Huez and to this giant circus, you know. And I, you know, there's a moment when I felt a little bit guilty for not actually riding up Alpe d'Huez and seeing the fans, but I actually had a great ride because, I mean, almost the entire day I had no traffic because I got up to Col de Lauderay because I was ahead of the race, so the road was closed. And then coming off Col de Lauderay, once again, the road was closed. And then I hit Col de Sirene, and, you know, because the road was closed, no one was driving it. So I essentially did a 70-kilometer ride with no traffic.
Oh, so it was like a party atmosphere, everyone else. It obviously not just because of Alpe d'Huez, which always attracts a party atmosphere, but because it's Bastille Day. And of course, Francois, this is an important day for France, but also always an important day on the Tour de France, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's always special for, you know, for French riders to ride on Bastille Day with French fans. Been probably more exciting than ever, and I mean, you know, the 14th of July. I mean, we have parties here in L'Alpe d'Huez because it's it's the race, but also probably because, you know, it's Bastille Day. A couple of riders have done well on Bastille Day. I mean, I remember Richard Virenque went in on Bastille Day. I remember Tony Galopin wearing the yellow jersey on Bastille Day. And today, I talked to Florian Sénéchal, who is the French champion, about what it meant to him. To be riding the Tour de France on Bastille Day with the, you know, tricolor flag on his back, and well, this is what he had to say.
For me, every day is for 14 July because all the French people were so crazy when he say to me in the road with this jersey. So today, I think it's more enthusiasm for the French people. It's nice, but also the parkour, for me, it's not the best parkour today. It's not the best stage, it's for climber.
Yeah.
But I know the next day is the same. I hope to Paris. It's also unbelievable, yeah. to bring this jersey to Champs-Élysées. Every day it's a crazy day for me because I never know this jersey can give to the French people. So every day on the road, I am a superstar, and wow, it's crazy. I hope I can have the jersey for next year in my career.
Well, on Bastille Day, in 2018 when I did the tour, it was a flat day. When we were up north. I think we started like maybe a week later, and to my surprise, it was my first tour and only tour, and I was surprised that no French riders had gone in the breakaway. There was no breakaway for the first 20 or 30K, not one attack. And I actually dropped back to car number one and I forget who was in it. Maybe it was Seb Piquet behind the race. And I asked them, and at the time I spoke better French than I do now, if I attacked, you know, would they give me a French passport? Because at the time, you know, every year I was dealing with this difficulty if I had to get my carte séjour and a visa. And I thought, you know what, will they give me an honorary French passport? Because I know in the UK you had several athletes, and I think Lizzie Deignan's received an honorary degree from a university. So I thought, maybe if I attack on Bastille Day, they'll give me an honorary French passport. That didn't work out, and I have since returned to the US.
Francois, would you give Ian a French passport, do you think?
Why not? I mean,
why not?
I mean, personally, if I was in charge of French passports, I would really give French passport to anyone who cares to, who wants one. You know, wherever you come from, you know, because I mean, this Bastille Day, we can get carried away and say, you know, France is a welcoming country, and you know, we welcome people from all around the world, and so yeah, I would definitely, and I mean, Ian has lived in France, he speaks quite, I mean, he doesn't speak a lot of French with me, but he speaks pretty good French. He knows the French culture and everything, and if I were, you know, the Minister of Interior, for sure I'd give him a French passport.
And talking of French culture, I should ask you, you know, what you are drinking there to celebrate Bastille Day. I hope it's a French beer.
So, I'll tell you what it is. It is Brasserie du Mont Blanc. So I mentioned two beers yesterday, one called Brasserie du Mont Blanc. We're having it now, and it's quite good, actually. You know, it's a lager with a little bit of body, you know, and very tasty, yes. You know, someone would have said. So it's fun, and the other one I saw yesterday in that shop was the famous La Bière du Crétin des Crétins des Alpes. And so it's a funny thing, because I told a little bit yesterday about Alpine cretinism, and you know, I thought that probably a lot of listeners would feel what has it got to do with cycling? I mean, I'm not saying there are not cretins in cycling, but never mind. So the funniest thing is, today we received an email from an endocrinologist, so very serious man, you know, knows his trade, called Simon Saunders, explaining what cretinism is, and apparently it's due to lack of iodine, you know. So if you don't have enough iodine, you develop that kind of symptoms defined by scientists as cretinism. The only thing you need to do is, you know, give iodine to those people, and the problem doesn't exist. So I suppose that if you live by the sea, where there's a lot of iodine, then probably you're less affected by cretinism than when you live far from the sea. But I mean, a number of places were mentioned by Simon Saunders, or obviously a listener, like Cleveland, Ohio, and even places in Derbyshire. So, guys, you know more about alpine cretinism than I ever did.
It's amazing what a question about beer can take you, isn't it?
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to sponsors of the cycling podcast, Science in Sport. Now, they have been powering us in more ways than one this week. Our producers, Hugh and Adam, both put in a mammoth effort to complete the étape up Alpe d'Huez at the weekend. And you can hear more about that in our Kilometre Zero episode, Tale of the Étape, out this morning. But both of them were fully fueled by Science in Sport products during their training, during the ride itself, and for the recovery afterwards, of course. To find out more about Science in Sport and get yourself 25% off all of their products, head to scienceinsport.com and use the code SISCP25. Now, we just had this amazing stage, and it feels like we haven't given enough airtime to talking about Jumbo Visma and the job they did in defending the yellow jersey. It was a very different team setup that we saw today than we saw yesterday, wasn't it, Francois?
Yeah, well, yesterday, I thought about it this morning. You know, sometimes when we wake up in the morning, say, "Oh, this is what I should have said in the podcast," you know, in the last episode. And you know, some people said, you know, that in the days of the Team Sky's dominance, you know, other teams should have, you know, attacked Team Sky or Ineos the way Pogacar was attacked yesterday. But there's a huge difference, you know. You had to attack six or seven guys at the time, and the situation yesterday was entirely different. It was six or seven guys attacking one guy, you know. And so in a way, we're back to normal now. The stronger team has got the stronger guy in the yellow jersey, and in a way, Jumbo-Visma played, you know, the guerrilla yesterday, and now that they are in power, they're riding a little bit more conservatively and in a more traditional fashion, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from several of the riders and staff yesterday at the top of the Granon, and I think the confidence with their team at the moment is super high, and you know, as Francois said, it is a very unique. Well, it was really rare that what we saw a couple of days ago with Pogacar being, you know, so strong, but his team really not being there. And I think when we look at Jumbo, they really do have an incredibly strong and deep team. And one thing that has been mentioned before is them kind of cycling riders. And this is something that people mentioned that happened at Team Sky and Ineos. I was never a part of being cycled through or having easy days. I just had days when I was good and days when I was bad. But I did notice that, you know, up until today, we hadn't really seen a lot from Sepp Kuss. I mean, he'd been there late into the race, but we didn't see Sepp like we saw him today, where he was actually, you know, up there, and he kept coming back, and you know, he was really a key, you know, really the key mountain domestique in today's stage. And I guess it makes me realize that this is probably part of the plan. This wasn't just, you know, Sepp just didn't happen to be on a good day. He had probably been kind of reserved for a stage like today.
Yeah, and I mean, he was impressive, absolutely, and we know that it was actually, you know, Team Sky, Team Ineos tactics to keep guys in reserve. I think I said yesterday that Sepp Kuss was probably the Pyrenees man, you know, while he was used a little bit earlier, and he was used today, I mean, to his limits, actually, and that's what he said when I actually had the chance to grab a few words from him. You know, not at the finish line, but as he was riding back to his hotel.
It was a tricky start, but we were in control the whole day. And the last climb, just wanted to keep a good pace. And we knew Pogacar would try and attack, but Jonas was responding right away, and he looked super good. There's a bunch of hard stages to come, and we can't... you know, take it easy yet, but we have a really strong team, and most importantly, Jonas is the strongest guy in the race right now, so that gives us all the confidence we need. Yeah, it was crazy. All the people, at first it's a bit too much noise, but then you get used to it, and it just gives you more power to keep going.
Did I see some interaction between you and a fan? Were you shouting at someone?
No, I was too out of breath to shout at anybody, but I was just looking, making sure the guy didn't trip and fall.
Now, we heard there Sepp Kuss, who was kind of given the responsibility over the last 5K, but it came to be that Pogacar didn't want to wait that long for Sepp Kuss to roll off and then just to attack Vingegaard. He kind of attacked Kuss and Vingegaard, didn't he, Boz?
Yeah, he did. And you know, one of my observations today, and I guess we heard in the media kind of overnight that Pogacar had said that he will attack on Alpe d'Huez. And he did make an attack near the top, but it wasn't a typical Pogacar attack. And I wonder if his attack was more of a, I'm going to fulfill the word that I said that I'm going to attack. Because he didn't really drop anyone. Everyone came back. You know, even Sepp Kuss came back. And I think even Enric Mas returned to the, you know, they almost slowed down more after his attack. And it wasn't, you know, where he attacked wasn't the smartest, but he attacked right before a switchback and he had to stop pedaling. And, you know, it was exciting for a second, but you very quickly realize that if Pogacar had been on a good day, he probably would have attacked earlier on the climb when it was steeper. You know, very seldom have we seen anyone go away that late on a climb, because it you know, as you kind of come into the village, it does tend to flatten out, and there are so many switchbacks that you can't really carry that much speed.
Yeah, it was kind of a surge of pride from Pogacar there, like a sound warning, like, look, you know, it's not finished. I attack, meaning I feel much better than I did yesterday. And wait, you haven't seen anything yet. And, you know, it was kind of, and it was funny because we had the impression that when you attacked, at one stage we saw Pogacar and Vingegaard almost side by side, like they were chatting, and like you had the impression that Jonas was telling Tade, "Oh, well tried, mate," or you know they were, and. It gives the impression, and that's really cool for the race, that they're enjoying themselves, that they're going to attack, strike, defend, you know, and it's a game that they play like kids, and you know, much to the pleasure of, I mean, the fans and us, you know, and it was refreshing to see, like, you know, well tried. In the past, it was Pogacar trying this kind of lame attempts to you know, topple Pogacar. Now the roles have been reversed a little bit, and it makes it even more exciting.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, I guess my thought is, you know, a former cyclist, that what Pogacar's best way to try and still win this tour was today to try to limit his losses, and he kind of did that. And that's why I think his, as Francois said, his attack was almost ceremonial. You know, he wanted to put on a show, and he wanted to show that he's still there. But being so close to the finish, and kind of as the climb flattens out, it wasn't really something that was going to distance anyone. And, you know, some people got dropped temporarily, but I think it was more of a sign of, okay, he knew he felt well enough that he was going to make it to the finish line with Vingegaard. He was going to make it, you know, and not lose time today. So he really kind of saved himself to a degree, made an effort, showed that he's still in the race. And, you know, then now we have a couple of days of him, you know, hopefully being able to recover before we hit the Pyrenees.
Yeah, I mean, Pogacar is a rider who, I mean, even when he was in the yellow jersey, he's very much, attack is the best form of defence, isn't he? But I believe, Ian, you caught up with his fiancée, Urszula Żygart, who is herself a fantastic rider for Team Bike Exchange. So let's hear what she had to say to you then.
Well, I'm here with Urszula. Did I say that correct?
It's Urszula, but really close.
And you are the fiancée of Pogacar, and you've been here since La Plonge de Belfi. We're now up at Alpe d'Huez. I mean, you said you're nervous. Why are you nervous?
Yeah, well, I'm just nervous because I want him to do his best, no? And yeah, it's just so many people, so many expectations. Everybody wants a big show, but I just want him to come through safe. And yeah, you never know what happens, so.
And did you have a chance to speak to Tade yesterday after the stage?
Yeah, I spoke to him in the hotel after. Yeah, nothing special, just I would say first real bad day for him in the past 2 years. So yeah, I think he just ran out of energy. It wasn't like he was lacking a little bit of watts. It was just, you could see that he just hit a wall. So yeah, nothing he can do about it now.
Well, and that's what I noticed. It's really like the first time we've seen him not dominate. And it was, I mean, of course, it's, you know, he's still so young. And even I saw him, I was up at the finish line, and he still was, you know, congratulating Vingegaard. And he still has this personality of being, he really just loves racing his bike. Is that, I mean, you know him better than anyone else. Is that the sense that he, but obviously once the expectations are put on him by team, by fans, by, you know, the amount of Slovenians at this tour, it's insane. Do you feel like that pressure is starting to become overbearing and it could take some of the fun out of it?
I think he's just really good with focusing on himself. And the thing you said, like, he just loves to ride his bike, race his bike, and he just always wants to do his best. And if somebody's better than him on the day, like, he accepts this because there's nothing he can do about it after. So, yeah, like you said, he just loves racing his bike, and every day is a new opportunity. He's achieved so much already that I think he's not really worried about one day, 2 days, or whatever happens. And yeah, he'll just try and do it tomorrow. I don't know.
Well, guys, I mean, we've got 9 more stages. So and we've got the Autocam next week. So the GC is definitely not wrapped up. But the King of the Mountains is also a competition that is showing a bit of interest, isn't it, Ian?
It is, yeah. I mean, we've, you know, Simon Geske's been in the jersey for a couple of days now, but, you know, obviously as we hit the high Alps, points become greater over the big climbs. And Louis Mankies, who, you know, has really made a strong return in this race, has kind of come back into contention. You know, I think he's several points behind, but, you know, there's still a lot of points to be gained. And, you know, both riders are exceptional climbers. You know, I guess if you put it on paper, you know, Louis is probably a slightly better, kind of more pure climber than Simon. But equally, the KOM competition is not always, I don't say it's not the best climber, because it typically is not the best climber. It's kind of the most creative rider who can also climb well. It's about getting in breakaways. It's about taking points when maybe they're not the biggest climbs, but you can actually acquire points.
And the guy who's going to do it, if it's not Tadej Pogacar, will read Tadej Pogacar of a jersey. He won for the last two editions as well. So this can also, it's kind of a new thing in a way. When obviously the green jersey is all set, unless something bad happens to Wout van Aert, which we don't. Obviously we don't hope to happen, but I mean, let's think about Tadej. He could lose his yellow jersey. He's in the position to lose his polka dot jersey. And how about the white jersey? I mean, Tom Pidcock showed today that he was a serious contender for the jersey as well. So actually, if you look at the different prizes, Tadej Pogacar is attacked on all fronts, in a way.
No, but I mean, we can all see that he is riding just for that yellow jersey, isn't he? I mean, he's not going to settle for having the white jersey. He'll risk everything for the yellow jersey, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a rider that, and when you look back at his career, he's thrived. So he's been so successful really from the beginning of his career. I think, one of the first times I heard his name was at Tour of California when he won. And, really since then, he's continued to win. And we heard from his fiancée that, yesterday was the first bad day that he had really had in the last 2 years. And so I wonder, and I think I said this last night, how much that'll affect his psyche. And, and once again today, maybe a showman attack, but he tried to attack, but he didn't get away. And so, I mean, are these things going to start to play on his psyche going forward, that he no longer has an iron fist on not just the yellow jersey, but, two other jerseys as well?
Well, we know as well that the Alps and Pyrenees are different, sides of the same planet, and one is for many riders, one is the dark side, the other one is the bright side. So, once again, everything can change. Another rider who won in La Bresse or in the past and won a Grand Tour at very young age was Fausto Coppi. I'm mentioning Fausto Coppi because the Italians won lots of stages of the Tour de France in Albrez, and it's pretty strange that there is no Italian corner, with pizza, pasta, and Chianti. It would be a little bit different, to be honest, and maybe an Italian singer, singing different stuff than the kind of techno stuff we have on the other corners. So, our Italian friends, what are you doing? And no, I'm mentioning that because it was the 70th anniversary of the first climb up L'Albuès today, and it was 1952, and Fausto Coppi that day was so good and so dominant that the organizers said, well, actually this slope is not so interesting. They thought it would make a difference like the Granon did yesterday, and it didn't, so they actually dropped it for 24 years, and the second time they went back there was in 1976, so it took them a long time to for the tour organizers to realize that L'Albuès could be a classic.
I do have to say, I've spent 3 days now with Francois, and I am just amazed that he can pull this stuff out of his head, that he can pull out just dates and facts. And I guess podcast listeners will know that, a lot about cycling, but we were at dinner last night, and it's not just about cycling. It's about politics. It's about geography. It's about, not even just, within France, but globally. And I have been blown away by your wealth of knowledge.
I'm just old, that's the thing. It's called old age.
Now we're revealing that Francois isn't just sitting behind a massive laptop looking everything up as he goes. It is actually all genuinely comes just straight off the top of the head, doesn't it, Francois? It helps when it helps with a little wine, I imagine, helps the thoughts.
The thing is, when with old age, you know lots of things, but you have to check from time to time that your memory serves you well, and it's always good that I have a date wrong or something, because then you can be sure that one of our listeners will point it out somewhere in the social networks. No, Francois, it was not 1952. It was in this case, I'm sure. But from time to time, you at the top of your head, you know something happened, so you go for it and you say, okay, my brain says it must be right. But and if it's not, you know, I know correction corner will be another one. You know, we should have correction corner on L'Alpe d'Huez. You know?
we should, because I actually am going to put this to the listeners to actually let me know if there have only been three British winners at the top of L'Alpe d'Huez in, I guess we could say, men's professional cycling. And I guess, you know, maybe there's another small race or a junior race that has come up here, but you know, I'm thinking of a world tour race that has finished atop Alpe d'Huez, and you know, my recollection is the three British riders who have won up here. There may be more, but I am not aware of it. Francois didn't know, and even Rod didn't know. So I believe I'm correct, but any listeners out there who are history buffs of cycling, please let us know if I'm incorrect in that fact.
I think now that we're kind of doing preemptive corrections corners, I think it's probably time that we wrap up this podcast. So thank you both for your company. Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Rose.
And we'll be playing you out tonight with a moment from another Bastille day and an image that will live long in the memory of every cycling fan, that's for sure. For our Tour de Buffalo tonight, we take you back to Chris Froome making a run for it on Mont Ventoux.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
Richard, what happened? What happened there?
The motorbike just stopped right in front of us.
Was that a fan as well?
I don't know. What the hell happens now?
Because of?
The motorbike crashed us.
Ah, shit. No, we didn't know that.
It can't. This can't be right, huh?
No.
Well, that was Richie Porte just after he crossed the finish line at Mont Ventoux today, meeting his press officer who didn't know what had happened in the closing stages of today's stage in the Tour de France. Lionel, where are we?
Well, we're now in a square in Orange, about an hour's drive down the mountain. Earlier on, though, we were at Chalet Reynard, 6 kilometres from the top of Mont Ventoux, where stage 12 of the Tour de France finished, from Montpellier to Mont Ventoux. And of course, if anyone doesn't know, the stage was shortened by 6 kilometres because the wind was blowing very strongly up there, wasn't it?
And it really was.
And that had all sorts of knock-on effects for the race today, didn't it?
Today, it was the final kilometre. Chris Froome, Richie Porte and Malcolm Mollema had broken clear from most of the other favourites, who were 23 seconds behind going to the final kilometre. To explain some of the challenges today, which were numerous, we were at the top of the mountain. We were watching the stage at the side of the Lotto Soudal team bus. They had a screen embedded in their bus and we were watching it there. We didn't see the actual incident where a motorbike stopped in front of that group of three and Richie Porte slammed into it. Chris Froome hit Richie Porte and then was hit himself by a motorbike, and his bike was broken. So we were watching it, and it was all, we saw that a BMC rider had a problem. I was standing beside Daniel Freeb, who said, well, that's TJ Van Garderen, obviously it's TJ. And the camera went back to the chase. Then the camera went to Chris Froome running up the mountain, and I don't think I'll ever forget that surreal sight. It was completely... And there's been a lot of bizarre things happened at the Tour over the years. This was the most bizarre thing I have ever seen.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.